Welcome to The World Below, The War in the Heavens, a podcast exploring the adventure, the intrigue, and the magic of a land that lies beneath the celestial battle between gods and demons, a clash that has gone on since time immemorial. I'm your guide, your interlocutor, and your host, Michael Pryor. Welcome, everyone, to episode 30 of The World Below, The War in the Heavens podcast, the 10th of season 3. This one is all about Daimon the Third, the Peaceful Monarch. Not every monarch is consequential, not even in Anarchist, not even if they're a member of the fearsomely talented, ambitious, and intelligent Anarchist family. Daimon the Third is, in some ways, a placeholder. Steady as she goes, nothing to see here, move on, folks. But let's see if we can find some juicy tidbits in his reign as monarch of Anarchist, the most fabled land in the entire world below the war in the heavens. The Overview. Good old Daimon the Third has been called unimaginative or even dull, but sometimes a realm needs a monarch like him to balance the overwhelming presence of some of the towering, swaggering, ambitious kings and queens in this remarkable dynasty. Really, though, he's only dull in comparison. Most of his subjects might have had that peaceful, easy feeling, but taken on his own merits, he was an admirable king, and his reign has many fascinating highlights. Daimon the Third was born in the year 421, and his birth name was Athanasius. Like his father, he adopted a regnal name, and so, when crowned, he became the third Daimon in a row, which some take as a sign of his lack of imagination, but I like to think that he was firm in his own conception of himself, and ready to continue what was already a family tradition. He was in the middle of three siblings, and as explained in our last episode, he was chosen by his father to succeed him thanks to getting top marks in an essay competition. That's only partly a joke, because King Daimon II, his father, asked each of his children to submit, in writing, reasons why they should succeed him. He judged Daimon's response to be the best, because neither of the others mentioned the people of Anarchist at all. And here's a sign of what was to come in Daimon the Third's reign. His childhood was remarkably trouble-free, with the realm being at peace within and without. He was educated, along with his siblings, mostly by the famous scholar-turned-tutor Vitalia Ashbolt. Vitalia was renowned as a philosopher with a decidedly empirical outlook, and was persuaded to leave the Hypogeum and join the royal household, where she educated the royal children for nearly 20 years. Given an almost free hand, she was greatly in favour of what we'd call a well-rounded education, with mathematics, languages, rhetoric, magic, and history balanced with music, practical arts, weapons training, and juggling. Daimon married Canute Jefbar in the year 440, and their first child, Daimon, was born the same year. Corin, a daughter, was born the year after, while two more children, Sendia and Ascot, were born in the years 444 and 446, respectively. Daimon came to the throne in the year 445, aged 31, and began a reign that was remarkably harmonious. Even his arrangements for the succession were relatively problem-free, when he asked his offspring to vote in secret for the one of them they thought best suited to take the crown, with the proviso they couldn't vote for themselves. He died in the year 454 at the age of 33 from an injury he sustained when backstage at the Great Theatre, stumbling on a prop and gashing himself on what was meant to be a blunt prop sword. The wound became infected, and despite heroic measures, he succumbed. Reign highlights. The Tumbling Mania. In a calm and peaceful time, the Tumbling Mania stands out. Although it generally inspires a laugh or two, the Tumbling Mania was a serious phenomenon that caused great concern within and without Anarchist. This plague erupted in Anacrest at the end of the year 445, in peak summer conditions that were hot and sweaty across the entire continent. Like most plagues or pandemics, this began slowly, with vague reports of something odd happening on the far southwest coast of the realm. The town of Mesgaling was the first named site of an outbreak of what became known as the Tumbling Mania. A number of first-hand records exist, journal entries and diaries of family members who first recorded the strange symptoms, long before any doctors or officials got around to making notes, and their descriptions are always laden with bafflement and despair. Now, whether this was a disease, a condition, or an outbreak of mass hysteria is unclear, as are its causes, but the Tumbling Mania was a matter of great concern, controversy, and heartache. Different people exhibited slightly different symptoms, but generally it began as a headache, or perhaps a slight fever. Soon after, and this could be within a matter of hours, limbs would start twitching before entering the final phase of the Tumbling Mania, and the sufferer would find themselves helplessly pitching forward into a somersault or forward roll. Some people would break into a cartwheel or even a series of backflips, but this sort of thing was uncommon. In the full grip of the Tumbling Mania, sufferers would cry out as they somersaulted and somersaulted again. If they were indoors, they would often crash into furniture or walls, injuring themselves, sometimes severely. Outdoors, they could tumble forward for hours until exhausted or too injured to continue. Naturally, older people suffered more, but the Tumbling Mania struck all ages. It spread quickly too, often running through households and families within a day, and soon it was believed that even seeing an afflicted tumbler was enough to pass on the disease. So many people went about averting their eyes and refusing to help others, even neighbours and people they knew. Deaths were uncommon but not unknown, and they were usually due to, as mentioned above, injury sustained in the helpless tumbling and flailing of limbs, rather than the disease or condition itself. The Tumbling Mania generally lasted only a couple of days, the irresistible urge to tumble gradually fading until it could be resisted, and then it disappeared entirely. Soon after the first sufferers began tumbling in Mesgaling, it quickly spread until everyone in the town evinced some level of symptoms. What was at first a ludicrous and laugh-worthy sight soon became a neighbourhood of despair, as those who were in the grips of the Tumbling Mania cried out, tears running down their cheeks as they helplessly somersaulted, tumbled, cartwheeled and rolled. When the mania began to die down, news came from other towns nearby that the Tumbling Mania had spread, and many were in its grip. The Tumbling Mania caused panic as it rolled across Anacrest. Towns tried isolating themselves, barricading the way to travellers, but it was futile. The Tumbling Mania had one town after another full of helpless and bruised acrobats. As the plague approached the capital city, Daimon III sent medicos, scholars and doctors to try to get to the bottom of the phenomenon, but apart from catching the mania themselves, rolling head over heels and flinging their notebooks to the winds as they did so, they achieved nothing. The capital city watched the progress of the Tumbling Mania across the realm with trepidation. "It's only a matter of time," said the doomsayers. Many fled the city and headed east, hoping to leave the plague behind. The doomsayers were right. In early 446, the Tumbling Mania struck Anacrest, the capital city of the realm of Anacrest. Soon, hundreds of thousands of people were rolling and somersaulting down the streets. Commerce, religion, industry and family life went by the wayside as sufferers were helpless in the grip of the condition. Deaths and injuries came not from the disease itself, but from unfortunate tumbling into deep water, off balconies, into fires. In a few weeks, the Tumbling Mania ran through Anacrest and was into the countryside to the east of the city, hopping from town to hamlet to settlement, before dying out on the far east coast. The last recorded case of the Tumbling Mania of 445-446 was on the island of Hitherto, off Point Calx, the easternmost extremity of Anarquist. A youth tumbled and rolled for 3 days without stopping before he prostrated himself, famished and nearly dead of thirst, and brought back to life only by the tender ministration of his parents. Modern experts have hazarded all sorts of guesses, ranging from spasms caused by eating mouldy grain to magical experiments gone wrong to an infectious delusion, but nothing is certain. The tumbling mania had faded by the end of the year, but continued to flare up over the next century and a half before disappearing entirely, with the last outbreak recorded in 1050 in the reign of Queen Sendia III. Magic. King Daimon III had always been interested in magic, an interest encouraged by his tutor, Vitalia Ashbolt, who was a magical theoretician of note, among other things. After becoming king, he regularly spent time in the Hypogeum, talking to practitioners and occasionally offering suggestions. In 448, he instituted an annual prize for the most innovative use of heavenly material in magic making. In the fine print, it was stated that the magical development had to be of profound use to the realm of Anarquist. The prize was an exquisitely crafted cup embedded with scales of the First Order, which alone would have attracted interest. But in addition, King Daimon promised land and a considerable yearly stipend. The announcement caused a frenzy in the Hypogeum and anywhere where anyone had any pretensions to magic use at all. Magical experiments got out of hand as practitioners did their best to come up with inventive magical devices and or processes. Explosions ruined a number of underground workshops in the Hypogeum, while transformations made some difficult to find again. Lives were lost, scales were stolen, and running battles were fought over the shortage. In the countryside, strange lights erupted at night in places where nothing magical had ever been witnessed before, and at least one tiny hamlet vanished entirely. After some months of this, King Daimon wisely cancelled the contest and instead gave the cup to his wife, Queen Canute. This wasn't the end of King Daimon's encouragement of or interest in magic. He was also interested in the skies, the proto-science of astronomy, and he made some fairly obvious suggestions that the Hypogeum might be able to find ways to examine the skies more fully than before, in an effort to better understand the eternal struggle in the heavens. Going one step further, he constructed the tower for heavenly observations in the stronghold that is still used in the present day by King Otho of Anarquist. Daimon also funded a small team of observers who assiduously recorded the night skies as they saw them right up until King Daimon's death. It has proved to be a useful series of volumes, as the observers didn't simply record the night skies. They included many observations of each other, their superiors, their liaisons, and the people in the streets below, thus resulting in a fascinating social document of the times. The most intriguing aspect of King Daimon's urging of heavenly observations was, apparently, the development in the technology of lenses. At this time, glass couldn't be made clear enough for satisfactory lenses, not even eyeglasses, so any notion of a glass-lensed telescope was fanciful and remained theoretical. However, the Hypogeum presented King Daimon with a device that easily brought the night skies nearer using the extraordinary invention of transparent scales. The actual inventor of transparent scales, or more properly, the inventor of the process that turned heavenly but opaque coloured scales into crystalline, totally see-through scales fit for fashioning into lenses, is unknown. Whether they were even known at the time is unknown, and no record of the process has survived until today. Only one telescope was made, and that vanished in the sack of Anarquist in the reign of Queen Willen IV in 1131. Another remarkable magical event occurred during the reign of King Daimon III, and that was the first ever recorded formal magical duel, where two foes wielded magic derived from the heavens above to settle a personal feud. Now, this isn't to say that enemies had never settled scores by magical means before. As soon as magic was harnessed, some turned their minds to using it for violence. Ambushes, traps, and then face-to-face combat where magic was flung at each other was rare, but not unknown. What happened in King Daimon's reign was the first formal duel, which was as far away from an upcountry magical brawling as it could be. Formal duels had been fought for as long as there had been aristocrats, upper-class oiks who were sure that they had reputations and that those reputations were worth fighting over. Swords were the usual choice, but in mid-winter 448, Calagenia Arkstam of the fabulously rich and landed Arkstam family demanded satisfaction from her one-time close friend Decima Ullinman for insulting her betrothed, Palinurius Verlison. This alleged offence had occurred at the Grand Midwinter Ball the week before, where Decima had apparently made comments about the dancing ability of Palinurus and drew conclusions about some other areas where he could be lacking. Both women were practitioners in the hypogeum, and they agreed that magical methods would be the appropriate manner of settling their dispute. The details of this highly formalised, tightly conventional confrontation come from Torbman and Insk, Magic in the World Below the War in the Heavens, and it's one of the liveliest parts of that monumental work. By this time in the history of Anarquist, the ridge to the north of the road to Beacon was taken up with some of the most magnificent houses, virtual palaces in their own right. A large park, well wooded, separated this part of the city from Lowtown, and it was in this park, on the bank of a stream that rushed its way to the Gepho River, that the duelists agreed to meet at dawn. The morning was crisp and very cold, but the duelists agreed to wear the by now traditional dueling gear of white tunic over black leggings. Their seconds took their cloaks and weapons were examined. As this was the first ever formal magical duel in the world below the war in the heavens, no rules existed for the weapons to be used. The seconds had negotiated for days before standards were agreed upon, and both combatants had brought very similar devices. Decima Ullinman's second was her cousin Servius. He wrote an account of the duel, and even made a sketch of the devices, so we have some idea of what the two duelists were presenting to each other. The result of the negotiations was that the foes could create a magical device which took an agreed number of scales, fashioned them into discs, then stacked them in an order that they desired. A hole would be bored through the centre of the stack, and when the stack was turned on its side, if all was well fashioned, it would present a multicoloured cylinder with an ominous hole to point at one's foe, a hole that would channel and aim the magical power that the wielder had calculated. Servius Ullinman was no magical practitioner, so he didn't bother to detail the colours of the scales, so we can only wonder at exactly what combination the duelists created. Hefting their own cylinder, the two moved apart the agreed-upon 30 paces. The overseer, the guardian of propriety, asked both if they wanted to continue, and neither demurred. He gave them the count of 3, and then the magic was unleashed. Bolts of fire, lightning, howling winds, and strange shimmering vapours sprang from the bore of both devices, but neither duelist flinched, and they were both enveloped in unearthly radiance. Calagenia Arkstam screamed, Decima Ullinman swore, and then the awful light stopped. Where the duelists had stood were two scorched patches. No trace of the women remained. Immediately the news was abroad, the temple slapped a ban on magical duels, calling them a blasphemous use of heavenly material. King Daimon proclaimed a similar ban, decrying the danger and the waste of life. Of course, such duels continued to occur over the centuries, risking substantial sanctions, but mostly they were held in secret. Continuing the theme of magic and heavenly affairs, during the reign of King Daimon, rumours of demon worshippers began to emerge. Of course, such things had been rumoured before, and since the existence of the gods was obvious to anyone who watched the heavens, the existence of their foes was equally obvious, to whom some were attracted. Individuals who claimed to worship demons had been around forever. They were usually pitied and treated as ill, or, depending on the mood of the time, killed out of hand. Whatever, demon worship was never an organized thing until these rumors began in the reign of King Daimon. The temple at this time was in the ascendant, so of course any sign of demon worship was treated extremely harshly. This, paradoxically, actually cultivated rumours, because any real demon worshipper, or organised worshipping, would have had to have taken place in secret, in basements and cellars, in special rooms, surrounded with great mystery and security. A perfect scenario to generate rumours. In 450, to great alarm and interest, such a sight was uncovered. A landlord went to a leather worker's workshop to demand unpaid rent to find the place was abandoned. He was shocked to find what he called an altar and the stuff of rituals in the cellar. He immediately notified the prime temple. Ecclesias swooped and stripped the cellar, then burnt down the workshop, which perhaps wasn't what the landlord had been expecting. A few days later, the prime ecclesiast announced that a den of cult worship had been destroyed. No evidence was produced, and no one who was part of this purported cult was brought forward. Not a few Anacrustians, notorious sceptics one and all, suggested that the temple itself set up this incident as a bogeyman. After all, if demon worshippers were around, the temple would need more power, more influence to combat them, right? King Daimon was silent on the matter. The Theatre-Goer. King Daimon, from an early age, was an enthusiastic theatre-goer, enjoying raucous comedies more than tragedies. In his late teens, before he came to the throne, he would often go backstage and chat with actors and playwrights, who found him thoughtful and supportive. Daimon was the one mostly responsible for reviving the reputation of the 2nd-century ribald dramatist Cinta Alanis. When he became king, he continued to attend performances, but his consorting with the playmakers lapsed. Nevertheless, he still showed his support for the art in an extremely practical way. The Theatre of Kenlil, usually known as the Great Theatre, was built in the reign of Queen Kenlil I in 161, and even though it was still the major venue for dramatic works, thanks to its seating capacity of nearly 2,000, by the time of Daimon III it was definitely showing its age. In 447, King Daimon instigated a major renovation and refurbishment of the Great Theatre, to the extent of replacing all the exterior white marble with exotic red marble from faraway Tras, which hereafter earned the theatre the nickname of the Great Apple. King Daimon also personally financed the construction of a smaller but more modern theatre just outside the walls of the stronghold on the western side of the city. The Theatre of Daimon had about 500 seats, so it was comparatively intimate compared with the huge Theatre of Kenlil, and its major advantage was the extensive backstage area that encouraged mechanical stagecraft. King Daimon particularly supported the use of magic in performances at this theatre, and soon the hypogeum, playwrights, stage managers and actors were collaborating to produce plays which had actors descending and ascending the stage thanks to clever mechanical and or magical devices. Light shows, rainbows, transformations, sound effects. This was the place for what we'd call today special effects or CGI, and it soon became a sensation. Crowds flocked to the Theatre of Daimon to see the latest astonishing performance. Old plays were revived, and many new playwrights emerged inspired by the staging possibilities afforded by magic. Names such as Blasius Ongink, Christa Emmermelt and Laurentia Amas had their first play staged at this time before going on to greatness, while actors lifted their game too, not prepared to be upstaged by special effects. The great and legendary Eliana Enskoch became a star by shining in such productions as Christa Emmermelt's The Fig Grower, and the acclaimed revival of Cinta Alani's The Man of Honour, where she played multiple roles, including the title character. An aside, Eliana Enscourge became a very good friend of King Daimon after Queen Canute died in 450, following a short illness. Eliana eventually had her own rooms in the royal apartments in the palace and was King Daimon's public companion at formal occasions, while continuing to work as one of the great actors of the age, with legendary performances not just in comedies but in tragedies like Fanlon's The Wrath of the Heavens. When King Daimon died in 454, she retired from the stage, never to act again, a loss for the ages. Some other bits and pieces. King Daimon III revived the Anaquist boat race, which hadn't been held at all during the latter part of the Nightmare Years, and had actually been falling into neglect for some time before that. His grandfather reinstated it, but it took King Daimon III to invest in it and raise it back to the yearly celebration that it had once been. Part of his effort was to order constructed a large column as the winning marker on the Miro River, a tapering conical obelisk clad in his favourite red marble and topped with a golden orb. The obelisk stayed there for hundreds of years until 778, when, after a cold winter meant the spring thaw had the Miro River high and then weeks of solid rain turned the high river into a flood, the bank where the obelisk stood was undermined and it toppled into the river, never to be seen again. Rumours, and if you haven't been paying attention, Anaquist is full of rumours, abound of adventurers or magic fabricators making devices that allowed underwater exploration and helped a daredevil find and steal the golden orb from its submarine resting place. No evidence, but a good story. Toward the end of Daimon's reign, reports of what could be called exploratory or tentative incursions by raiders from the inland began to filter to the capital, with settlers and towns in the northwest calling for help. In response, Daimon ordered a fort to be constructed in this area, far from any existing settlement, roughly in the area where Queen Grippina had located an army outpost, long since abandoned. The fort of River Bend eventually became a town in its own right, as people were attracted to settle around it, relying on it for safety. The town is still there in present-day Anaquist, prosperous, even though the fort is mostly a museum these days. And since we're getting down to the nitty-gritty, it tells us something about King Daimon III that he was at great pains to improve the water and sanitation throughout the capital, and not just in the stronghold and the royal palace. He established a position with importance just below that of the advisory council, and this position had the sole responsibility for water and sanitation. He ordered this commissioner to investigate the state of water supply and sewage, the result of which was the building of many new fountains throughout Lowtown for the everyday supply of water to its many inhabitants. Personal life. King Daimon III was an anarchist, even though he wasn't as ruthless and ambitious as most. After seeing the Nightmare Years, he was driven to make his reign peaceful as possible, and to some extent he succeeded. He favoured the arts over more martial pursuits like hunting, and he encouraged Anaquist as a place where culture could thrive. He managed the succession with a minimum of fuss, and his son Daimon was accepted by his siblings as the heir with no argument. Daimon was reputed to be one of the most handsome of the Anaquists, and many busts were made of him. Sadly, few remain, but those that do show us a man of striking good looks, mostly due to outstanding cheekbones. And that's it for King Daimon III, a peaceful monarch. And that's also the end of Season 3 of the World Below the War in the Heavens podcast. I'll be back before too long with Season 4, and in the meantime, don't forget to subscribe and like. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, so keep an eye on them for developments. Farewell, and may the heavens smile on you. This has been The World Below the War in the Heavens, a podcast exploring the history, culture, and esoterica of the world below, a continent of magic and mystery with inhabitants who keep one eye on the sky at all times. I've been your host, Michael Pryor. If you'd like to find out more about me and my books, pop over to www.michaelpryor.com.au. Farewell.